Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Friday on the front porch, on the horn. It is a lovely day. It matters not much what the weather is like, wherever you may be in the United States of America, or if you sympathize with put-upon people in the United States of America. It is a lovely day. This is the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. That's where you go if, among other things, you need access to the Listen Live button, which is the easiest way to get to stream the program. It's also easy to jump into the Horn chat room, which is as simple as picking out a screen name and a password, diving into the real-time multimedia extravaganza that takes place every evening during the program. Good evening to Anatole. Good evening, Jeremy in Vermont, who informs us loud and clear on TuneIn. Thank you, Jeremy. Good evening, Jug of Punch. Good evening, Texas T. And good evening to chat room moderators Lottie, Sparky, and Texas Betsy. Let's see. We are underway for this Friday on the front porch, the 26th day of June, 2015. Also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will find the interface for supporting the program. Because this is, after all, a listener-supported program, and we find ourselves needing $400 to close the week. We pulled up a little bit short in the first 4 days of the week. We need $400 to finish the week okay, more than that if we want to get started on next week. And, program note, I will be, and this is probably an appropriate time to mention it, I will be away from the microphone the week following the 4th of July weekend. What does that mean? That means that July 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th, no program, at least as presently constituted. So that means we will, by definition, fall behind in fundraising the second week of July. I think there's a pretty good reason for it. We are taking, we're making a trip to D.C. on behalf of the AIC campaign and on behalf of poisoned Appalachian people everywhere to use what last little bit of money we have in the AIC campaign coffers to make a as big a push as we possibly can to get the bill introduced in the Senate and raise even more awareness of the human rights, human public health disaster that unfolds daily in the hills and hollers of the sacrifice zone that is Central Appalachia. So that's going to make things a little bit difficult, and for that reason, it is absolutely critical that we meet the evening's fundraising goal and finish up the week okay, raising $400 this evening. I just hope we can. I really, really do hope we can. Now, if, of course, and the usual applies, if you would prefer to use the United States Postal Service, the address is The Horn for checks and money orders made payable to The Horn. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V 25801. And, of course, the easiest and fastest way to go about it is via PayPal. And the interface is under the Contribute tab. And you just fill out the basic information. You can ignore the really intrusive stuff. Click Next, get to the next screen, and make your choices between credit cards, PayPal account, what have you. That's the easiest way. Whatever way we do it, whether it's 40 people at $10, 10 bucks at 40 people, 1 at 400, 2 at 200, 4 at 100, 8 at 50, or 16 at 25. Well, we just need to get it done. Oh, hi. I'm Bob Kincaid. Yeah. And, of course, this is Friday on the front porch. And in about 55 minutes or so, we will begin the evening's extraordinary, ordinary roundtable discussion of the events of the day. Pretty much anything y'all want to discuss. If you have never participated in Friday on the front porch, I certainly encourage you so to do. Just send on Skype, mind you, which is incredibly easy, simple, almost mindless to use. On Skype, send a contact request to Sparky Dunk, S-P-A-R-K-Y-D-U-N-C. Sparky is awaiting your contact request out in 106-degree Northern California with Mount Lassen in his vista. And if you send him a contact request, he'll get you all hooked up, and you'll be part of the Friday on the Front Porch conversation, and you are certainly welcome to join in, and I hope you will. For people who have a hard time dealing with Skype, there's always the stress line. And for the time being, the stress line number is area code 304-640-8185. Okay? So hopefully that gets all of the details out of the way. It really is a magnificent day, you know, because, of course, you don't live under a rock. Many of you listen to a lot of other progressive radio programs. You know that the Supreme Court, I had predicted that they would issue their ruling on the 30th day of June on marriage equality, and would then hit the road. I think if the ruling had gone the other way, that's exactly how it would have played out. But instead, they did it as part of the Friday news dump, giving, and I think it was a charitable act. They may be elevated to the rarefied atmosphere of the highest level of the judiciary, but these are 9 human beings who understand the needs of the 24-hour news cycle. And so, of course, they issued their marriage equality ruling today so that poor Chuck Todd wouldn't have to run another report about murder that featured a whole bunch of black people. America didn't need that last Sunday. So, yes, as a result of the marriage equality ruling, the lead plaintiff of whom was a man named Jim Obergefell, the Sunday shows will have plenty to blather on about. I have a feeling Sunday's going to be rather interesting. But the howling has already begun. And we will, of course, give a listen to some of it, or consideration to some of it. The howling commenced with the publication of the majority opinion. Because, of course, it was accompanied by a dissent. Dissents being authored by John Roberts and by Fat Tony Scalia. And by Clarence Slappy Coke Can Thomas, and by Sammy Bad Breath Alito. Yeah, we'll be giving consideration to all of that. But I want to remark upon something in a good and positive manner before we get into the madness. Because I did. I'm a sentimental fool. And my eyes welled up with tears of pride for this deeply challenged, deeply divided nation when the news broke today. Among other things, I really puddled up real good when the man who had the most to celebrate out of all of this, Jim Obergefell, stepped to the microphone in front of the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. this morning to give a statement. Because I understood then that by virtue of the oppression and discrimination to which he and his beloved have been subjected, that he has learned the meaning of equality, and that it is not merely a word, but a matter of life and death to him. Because Jim Obergefell, a white man, a white gay man, a white married gay man, Jim Obergefell took time out of his remarks to say that in the midst of his happiness, he wanted to make sure to take a moment to mention those who are still grieving in Charleston, South Carolina. And sad I am that I do not have the exact quote before me, but he said something to the effect that we are reminded today that until all are free, until all have equality, we are all diminished. I thought that was deeply important. Because there are underlying effects to the ruling today, which will have a profound political effect across the country. People are politicized and motivated for a variety of reasons. For instance, the Republican Party still exists as a major national party, for the most part, because of the issue of women's reproductive choice. As long as the Republicans have abortion to screech and scream and wail and whine and piss and moan and bellyache about, they will be able to whip their supporters into a white-hot frenzy, and I do mean white, in order to get them to the polls. The converse is also true. Or is at least concerning. I sincerely hope that having gained this signal, monumental triumph, that the LGBT community and its allies will not make the mistake that liberals and progressives have made so many times before, and say, yay, we won, we can all go home now, everything's okay. Because everything isn't. For those of us who are progressives on any and all fronts, the key to moving forward in this nation is that we stand together, united. You know, united we stand, divided we fall, that. That we understand that the rights of marriage equality are co-equal and, in fact, in many ways the same as a woman's right to choose the hows and whens and whys and ifs of her reproductive life. And that those rights are the same rights as the rights of immigrant workers to be treated humanely and decently. And that those rights are the same rights as those of people beset by massive corporations intent in the name of profit upon poisoning ordinary individuals who live near their profit extraction centers. And that those rights are the same rights as the rights of people seeking a living wage in this country. Now, the right-wingers are always motivated, perennially motivated, and it is simply factual that this decision today will only motivate them more. They're not going to just get over it. They're not going to go away. They're going to continue to howl and bark and yawp and screech and scream and shriek about traditional marriage and family values at each and every turn. Presidential candidate, and God knows why, Piyush Jindal, has already called for the passage of a constitutional amendment defining marriage as that between one man and one woman. And so we see that the struggle does not end. And so I hope it is that the political power that the LGBTQ community has manifested does not dissipate like wind-blown fog. And it was the words of Jim Obergefell that made me hope that it won't, that they won't. But what a lovely day. What a lovely day for millions and millions of absolutely decent, loving Americans. What a lovely day for people all around the world who still look to the United States of America as a beacon of hope, freedom, and justice. We may not even deserve that anymore, but today, today we earned back a little bit of it. Now, as I noted, the howling and the shrieking began with the publication of the dissents. Clarence Slappy Coke Can Thomas is not happy. He's really not happy. In his dissent, Slappy Thomas said, and in the wake of the discussion, the national discussion about race that has been going on for the last week or so, this shows a certain tone deafness on the part of Slappy that is surprising even for him. A big part of the majority decision had to do with human dignity And because he was the necessary swing vote, Anthony Kennedy got to write the majority opinion so that he can be famous for something good. But that opinion focused on issues of dignity. And the words written were, in fact, lovely and inspiring. But they were infuriating, all that talk about human dignity, to Clarence Slappy Coke Can Thomas, who wrote, "Slaves did not lose their dignity any more than they lost their humanity because the government allowed them to be enslaved. Those held in internment camps did not lose their dignity because the government confined them. And those denied governmental benefits certainly do not lose their dignity because the government denies them those benefits. The government cannot bestow dignity, and it cannot take it away," said the Supreme Court Justice who got everything in his entire life via affirmative action, and has worked tirelessly ever since to make sure that he pulls the ladder up behind him lest anyone follow. The government cannot bestow dignity, but it can damn sure take it away. Because dignity was deeply damaged by Chief Justice Roger Taney's Dred Scott decision. Because if you don't have the right to not be property, your dignity is, shall we say, at an ebb. Those imprisoned in internment camps. Notice Slappy only says held. No, there were machine guns. Did not lose their dignity because the government confined them. I call bullshit again, because that is a deliberate attempt to take away people's human dignity. And notice how he refers to marriage equality and the fact that it comes with marriage, it comes with a lot of governmental rights, preferences. Notice that those rights conferred by marriage are referred to by Slappy as governmental benefits. You know, like it's some sort of welfare. Clarence Slappy Coke Can Thomas reminds us all that elevation to the Supreme Court of the United States is no guarantee that one is not, in fact, an idiot. Because Clarence Slappy Coke Can Thomas is, in fact, an idiot. His dissent is a real Lulu. You know, it wasn't long ago that he was that Slappy was writing about NBA players as proof that sometimes race can be a benefit. No, really. J. Justice Kennedy really did, or his clerk, actually, really did try to craft a humane decision. He said, the Constitution promises liberty to all within its reach, a liberty that includes certain specific rights that allow persons within a lawful realm to define and express their identity. The petitioners in these cases seek to find that liberty by marrying someone of the same sex and having their marriages deemed lawful on the same terms and conditions as marriages between persons of the opposite sex. Clear and concise. He then goes into a procedural history of how the cases got there. He offers up an understanding of marriage that, frankly, is at odds with my historical understanding of the institution. He says, from their beginning to their most recent page, the annals of human history reveal the transcendent importance of marriage. The lifelong union of a man and a woman always has promised nobility and dignity to all persons without regard to their station in life. Marriage is sacred to those who live by their religions and offers unique fulfillment to those who find meaning in the secular realm. Its dynamic allows two people to find a life that could not be found alone, for a marriage becomes greater than just the two persons. Rising from the most basic human needs, marriage is essential to our most profound hopes and aspirations. The centrality of marriage to the human condition makes it unsurprising that the institution has existed for millennia and across civilizations. Since the dawn of history, and this is where I start having a little problem, marriage has transformed strangers into relatives, binding families and societies together. Well, there's an element of truth there, because quite often when a woman who was deemed chattel property of her father was bargained, sold, and conveyed away to a purchaser for value in what was called marriage, she was quite often marrying a total stranger who would celebrate and seal the deal and accept the transfer of title by performing coitus upon her with or without her consent on the wedding night. You know, rape. But I guess Justice Kennedy didn't want to be a big killjoy about things and talk about the real history of marriage, to wit, property transfers. Instead, he said, and this will drive the right-wingers, I mean, crazier, he didn't cite the Bible, he cited that confusion. Mm-hmm. That Chinaman. Confucius taught that marriage lies at the foundation of government. This wisdom was echoed centuries later and half a world away by Cicero, who wrote, the first bond of society is marriage, next children, and then the family. There are untold references to the beauty of marriage in religious and philosophical texts spanning time, cultures, and faiths, as well as in art and literature in all their forms. It is fair and necessary to say that these references were based on the understanding that marriage is a union between two persons of the opposite sex. The petitioners acknowledge this history, but contend that these cases cannot end there. Were their intent to demean the revered idea and reality of marriage, petitioners' claims would be of a different order, but that is neither their purpose nor their submission. To the contrary, it is the enduring importance of marriage that underlies the petitioners' contentions. This, they say, is their whole point. Far from seeking to devalue marriage, the petitioners seek it for themselves because of their respect and need for its privileges and responsibilities, and their immutable nature dictates that same-sex marriage is their only real path to this profound commitment. And, as is so often the case of a Supreme Court opinion, narrative continues at length. Eventually, he gets around to saying, under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The fundamental liberties protected by this clause include most of the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights. In addition, these liberties extend to certain personal choices central to individual dignity and autonomy, including intimate choices that define personal identity and beliefs. Interestingly, and this is interesting, among those personal identity and beliefs protected under equal protection, he specifically cites Griswold versus Connecticut. And, of course, Griswold versus Connecticut is the cornerstone of the entire reproductive choice line of cases. Griswold versus Connecticut essentially made constitutional the right to have access to contraception. And it is Griswold versus Connecticut that ultimately the right wing seeks to overturn, not Roe versus Wade. We should always remember that we have a right wing in this country, comprised mainly of evangelical fundamentalists, who seek not simply to prevent a woman from being able to have an abortion, but to prevent a man from being able to buy a condom. That is the profundity, that is the depth of depravity that is the American right wing, and in particular the Christian evangelical fundamentalist sect. But enough, you get the idea. Of how Justice Kennedy goes about reaching his conclusions. He cites previous court cases, particularly Loving versus Virginia, overturning the ban on interracial marriage in old Virginia. Quoting from Loving, saying, there can be no doubt that restricting the freedom to marry solely because of racial classifications violates the central meaning of the Equal Protection Clause. With this link to equal protection, the court proceeded to hold the prohibition offended central precepts of liberty. To deny this fundamental freedom on so unsupportable a basis as the racial classifications embodied in these statutes, classifications so directly subversive to the principle of equality at the heart of the 14th Amendment, is surely to deprive all the state's citizens of liberty without due process of law. The reasons why marriage is a fundamental right became more clear and compelling from a full awareness and understanding of the hurt that resulted from laws barring interracial unions. This, by the way, was a shot right across Slappy Coke Can Thomas's bow. Because, see, while Slappy Coke Can Thomas don't want none of them homosexuals a-getting married, he is quite comfortably married to a white woman. And that probably accounts for why his dissent is so absolutely shitty and pissy. Because, oh my God, it is. And one cannot help but wonder if, in fact, arguments put forward by Clarence Slappy Coke Can Thomas may have been the thing that pushed Anthony Kennedy to the majority side, to side with Breyer and Ginsburg and Kagan and Sotomayor. The rank, vile hypocrisy of having a man whose very life is defined by freedoms guaranteed and enforced under the 14th Amendment sit there and say, well, there's nothing in the Constitution says the homos can get married. Get me a Coke and knock that pube off the can, would you? In a moment of sublime irony, John Roberts, the Darth Smartiest of the Republican Party, actually cited Dred Scott as his reason for denying gay people the right to marry. No, really. Only he cites the dissent. Dred Scott's holding was overruled on the battlefields of the Civil War, he continues, and by constitutional amendment after Appomattox, but its approach to the Due Process Clause reappeared. In a series of early 20th century cases, most prominently Lochner, this court invalidated state statutes that presented meddlesome interferences with the rights of the individual and undue interference with liberty of person and freedom of contract. In Lochner itself, the court struck down a New York law setting maximum hours for bakery employees because there was, in our judgment, no reasonable foundation for holding this to be necessary or appropriate as a health law. Now, bear in mind that Lochner is one of those wet dream cases that your really, really hardcore right-wing teabagger types think was rightly decided. Oh, their dudgeon was high with this. So, John Roberts thinks that today's decision is co-equal with two of the nastiest decisions in the history of the Supreme Court, to wit, Dred Scott and Lochner. That's right. The Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court said letting gay people get married is the very same thing as declaring that a black person isn't really a human being. He says letting gay people get married is exactly the same thing as when the Supreme Court said that working people could not be protected from predatory employers. That is how sick and twisted the right wing of this court is. You begin to get the picture, don't you? I mean, we all do. But never mind Slappy Coke Can Thomas. The real dissenting highlight of today's decision. I mean, the one that makes you run out and grab the popcorn. Is of course the son of the Mussolini fan club of America, Antonin Fat Tony Uncle Nino Scalia. He wrote, and you might want to have the hockey puck handy. I'm just saying here. Because there's some real screamers in here. And by the way, just a few notes coming in. With regard to the whole dignity argument from Clarence Slappy Coke Can Thomas, Steve in New York City notes. Oh, really? And and the whole dignity. But, tell that to the Jews and the African Americans about the dignity. Yeah. By the way, Steve also put forward a $25 challenge. He will match the next $25 that come in. And if that happens, we will have knocked down a quarter of the evening's fundraising goal. And thank you very kindly to Texas Betsy for the other half of that. So $25 to match Steve's, and then we will be, well, a quarter of the way toward where we need to be to finishing the week okay. But back to Fat Phony. I joined the Chief Justice's opinion in full. I write separately to call attention to this court's threat to American democracy. The substance of today's decree is not of immense personal importance to me. I could care less about your average homo and whether they get married. The law can recognize as marriage whatever sexual attachments and living arrangements it wishes, and can afford them favorable civil consequences from tax treatment to rights of inheritance. Those civil consequences and the public approval that confer in the name of marriage evidences can perhaps have adverse social effects, but no more adverse than the effects of many other controversial laws. You know, controversial laws, like Jim Crow. You know, had I been Chief Justice back then, I wouldn't have voted to overturn none of them Jim Crow laws. The Congress can do whatever it wants. Especially with regarding, you know, those people. Because after all, I am a constitutional originalist, and it is patently obvious to me that the framers of the Constitution knew about slavery and chose not to do nothing about it, so the Constitution don't care. Not the same with the homos, as far as I'm concerned, you know. Anyways, it is not of special importance to me what the law says about marriage. It is of overwhelming importance, however, who it is that rules me. And that would be your Opus Dei there, for those of you wondering at home. Today's decree says that my ruler and the ruler of 320 million Americans, coast to coast, is a majority of the 9 lawyers on the Supreme Court, which actually should be me, the majority. I would actually like to be maximum dictator of the Supreme Court for life. You know, the kind of man with the iron will to lead a nation, like Mussolini was, which was why my father so admired him. The opinion in these cases is the furthest extension, in fact, and the furthest extension one can even imagine of the court's claimed power to create liberties that the Constitution and its amendments neglect to mention. Huh? It ain't in there. I ain't heard nothing. This practice of constitutional revision by an unelected committee of 9, always accompanied, as it is today, by extravagant praise of liberty, robs the people of the most important liberty they cited in the Declaration of your Independence Day, and one in the Revolution of 1776, of which my family was not participating, the freedom to govern themselves. Until the courts put a stop to it, public debate over same-sex marriage displayed American democracy at its best. American democracy is at its best when pastors in Texas are threatening to set fire to themselves because a couple of guys can pick out a China pad and you know that. That's American democracy at its best. American democracy is at its best when your right-wing radio hosts are out there talking about how the homosexuals is causing your volcanoes and your tornadoes and your earthquakes, although we all know that that's fracking. Individuals on both sides of the issue, passionately, but respectfully, you know, like Brian Fisher, who says that all homosexuals is all you pedophiles there, attempted to persuade their fellow citizens to accept their views. Americans considered the arguments and put the questions to a vote, and the electorates 11 states, either directly or through their representatives, chose to expand the traditional definition of marriage. More and more, many more decided not to. Because, you know, majority rule is the rule of the day. I mean, my people, when we came over from the old country, you know, there was a lot of people who said, you know, your Italians need not apply. And that was the majority rule, and we was okay with it. You know, until we banded together and formed certain little community social organizations whereby, you know, we could convince them that maybe they was in the wrong, you know, with the occasional bullet through the back of the head or the brick through the window. Right. Win or lose, advocates for both sides continued pressing their cases, secure in the knowledge that an electoral loss can be negated by a later electoral win. That is exactly how our system of government is supposed to work. The Constitution places some constraints on self-rule. Constraints adopted by the people themselves when they ratified the Constitution and its amendments. You know, forbidding the laws, impairing the obligation of contracts. That's there right there in your Constitution. Denying full faith and credit to the public acts of other states. That's in your Constitution. Prohibiting the free exercise of religion, and abridging the freedom of speech, and infringing the right to keep and bear arms. You saw how I mentioned the keeping and bearing of arms, right? Yeah, has the check cleared? Good. I'd hate to send anybody around to make sure that it did. Authorizing unreasonable searches and seizures and so forth and so on. And what have you. Aside from these limitations, those powers reserved to the states respectively or to the people can be exercised as the states or the people desires. These cases ask us to decide whether the 14th Amendment contains a limitation that requires the states to license and recognize marriages between two people of the same sex. Does it remove that issue from the political process? Eh? Does it? Eh? Stifle eat it. Of course not. It would be surprising to find a prescription regarding marriage in the federal Constitution since, as the author of today's opinion reminded us only 2 years ago in an opinion joined by the same justices who joined him today, regulation of domestic relations is an area that has long been regarded as a virtually exclusive province of the states. The federal government, through our history, has deferred the state law policy decisions with respect to your domestic relations. But we need not speculate. When the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, every state limited marriage to one man and one woman, and no one doubted the constitutionality of doing so. That resolves these cases. Huh. How about that? 1868 resolves cases today. Yeah, I don't think so. When it comes to determining the meaning of a vague constitutional provision such as due process of law, equal protection of the laws, it's unquestionable that the people who ratified that provision did not understand it to prohibit a practice that remained both universal and uncontroversial in the years after the ratification. Isn't it interesting, since he's on the same dissenting side as his buddy Slappy Coke Can Thomas, that he says that marriage was one man and one woman in 1868, and therefore there was no issue with it, without noting that the entire South, they all had their own little anti-miscegenation laws, forbidding white folks and black folks from getting married. And probably even from, not really from having sex, because, old Mars still, he might not have been Mars no more, but he still had his needs and his urges that the old missus couldn't quite fulfill. I lie back and think of old Virginia. Since there is no doubt whatever that the people never decided to prohibit the limitation of marriage to opposite-sex couples, the public debate over same-sex marriage must be allowed to continue. Here's a hint. It will. I have evidence. But the court ends this debate, and in an opinion lacking even a thin veneer of law, buried beneath the mummeries and straining to be memorable passages of the opinion, is a candid and startling assertion. No matter what it was the people ratified, the 14th Amendment protects those rights that the judiciary, in its reasoned judgment, thinks the 14th Amendment ought to protect. This is so because the generations that wrote and ratified the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment did not presume to know the extent of freedom in all of its dimensions. Here the smartassery gets ratcheted up to 11. One would think that sentence would continue, and therefore they provided a means by which the people could amend the Constitution, or perhaps, and therefore they left the creation of additional liberties, such as the freedom to marry someone of the same sex, to the people through the never-ending process of legislation. But no! What logically follows in the majority's judge in power and estimation is, and so they entrusted to future generations a charter protecting the right of all persons to enjoy liberty as we learn its meaning. The we, needless to say, is the nine of us. History and tradition guide and discipline our inquiry, but do not set its outer boundaries. Thus, rather than focus on the people's understanding of liberty, and by the people I mean teabaggers and the people who who like it when I write this kind of crap. At the time of ratification, or even today, the majority focuses on four principles and traditions that, in the majority's view, prohibit states from defining marriage as an institution consisting of one man and one woman. This is a naked judicial claim to legislative, indeed super legislative, power. Maybe I ought not have used the word naked, but I couldn't help it. Except as limited by a constitutional prohibition agreed to by the people, the states are free to adopt whatever law they like. Even those that offend the esteemed justice's reasoned judgment. The system of government that makes the people subordinate to a committee of nine unelected lawyers does not deserve to be called a democracy unless the nine unelected lawyers is led by a majority that's led by me, in which case they better by God obey, or I'll send somebody around. Oh, it goes on and on and on, sweet Jesus. Then at the beginning of section two, because that was section one. Oh, wait. No, I can't. I got to share with you. He's pissed off about how the courts are, how the courts comprised. Judges, as selected precisely for their skill as lawyers, whether they reflect the policy views of a particular constituency is not or should not be relevant. Now, this here is a lie, and I'm telling it, but you know what? I'm a member of the Supreme Court, and can't nobody bust me for doing it except the Congress, and those dumbasses can't figure out what time to have lunch, so I figure I'm all right. And why is it a lie? Well, it's a lie because, see, policy views of a particular constituency are exactly why nominees to the Supreme Court are selected. It is, in fact, how I got selected. Because the guy who selected me, you know, Ronnie Reagan, sitting there at the right hand of God, even as we speak. Hand of God, he is. I got it from the old Pope. He told me. He said, yeah, Ronnie's right there. Ronnie picked me because I was crazier. Because I was the most right-wing, crazy, out there running naked in the grass conservative he could find. But I hid it all behind a wall of seeming respectability by talking about how much I revered the framers and how important it is that I thought their vision of their original intent was. So it made me sound like some sort of serious intellectual, don't you know? So what I said there about being selected for their skill as lawyers, you know what? All nine of us together probably couldn't defend against a goddamn traffic ticket in magistrate court. We ain't lawyers. Or not much of them. We're your ivory tower intellectuals. Anyway, let me get on. Not surprisingly, then, the federal judiciary is hardly a cross-section of Merck. Take, for example, this court, which consists of only 9 men and women, with at least 3 too many women. All of them successful lawyers who studied at Harvard or Yale Law School. 4 of the 9 are natives of New York City, like myself. 8 of them grew up in East and West Coast states. Only 1 hails from the vast expanses in between. Not a single Southwesterner, even to tell the truth, a general Westerner. California does not count. You hear me? Not a single evangelical Christian, a group that comprises about 1/4 of Americans, or even a Protestant of any denomination. Some things we get right. If we can get rid of that Jew, we'll be on the way. What we need here is 9 good Opus Dei Catholics. Then maybe we can start to save America from itself. The strikingly unrepresentative character of the body voting on today's social upheaval. Really? Social upheaval? There's going to be social upheaval? What? The radio stations are all going to quit playing country music and everything's going to have to be broadcast at 138 beats per minute? What the... Really? Would be irrelevant if they were functioning as judges, answering the legal question whether the American people had ever ratified a constitutional provision that was understood to proscribe the traditional definition of marriage. But of course, the justices in today's majority are not voting on that basis. They say they're not. And to allow the policy question of same-sex marriage to be considered and resolved by a select patrician, highly unrepresentative panel of 9 is to violate a principle even more fundamental than no taxation without representation. No social transformation without representation. Yeah. Because, see, I mean, like, back before 1860, there was lots of representation. And there was folks trying to get your social transformation there. And there was representation, except for the people who wasn't, you know, free nor citizens, you know, or even five-fifths human. But the ones that was fully human, they was a representing into Congress, and they said that nobody could raise no laws, not say not a word about slavery in the House of Representatives. See, that's what we mean when we say no social upheaval without, no social transformation without representation. But for a man whose daddy was an avowed fascist, to write the next sentence is kind of proof that the great big juvenile delinquent sky god up there isn't. Because this is lightning bolt material. I mean, just right down out of the sky. Nothing left but a little puddle of olive oil there where Fat Tony was. Hey, what happened to Uncle Nino? Well, he started talking bullshit, and the Lord took him out. I'm going to read this without the accent. But what really astounds is the hubris reflected in today's judicial putsch. And he even capitalizes putsch with a capital P, the way German capitalizes nouns. Yeah. He called it a judicial putsch. A putsch, of course, being a seizure of power contrary to the established governmental structure, when in fact the Supreme Court is part of the established governmental structure. Now, the son of America's chief Italian fascist just referred to the opinion in which he did not carry the day as a putsch. Has a Supreme Court justice ever lost an argument by invocation of Godwin's law? Because if he hasn't, now he has, and it's Fat Tony Scalia. Your five justices there who composed today's majority are entirely comfortable concluding that every state violated a constitution for all of the 135 years between the 14th Amendment's ratification and Massachusetts's permitting of same-sex marriages in 2003. They have discovered in the 14th Amendment a fundamental right overlooked by every person alive at the time of ratification. And almost everyone else at the time since. They see what less illegal minds like your Thomas Cooley and your John Marshall Harlan, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. and the Learned Hand and your Louis Brandeis and your William Howard Taft and your Benjamin Cardozo and your Hugo Black. Probably best not to reference Hugo Black. He was a Klansman. Your Felix Frankfurter and your Robert Jackson and Henry Friendly could not. They are citing that the people ratified the 14th Amendment to bestow on them the power to remove questions from the democratic process when that is called for by their reasoned judgment. See, this is another one of those moments where it's pretty obvious that Uncle Nino's medication isn't working anymore. Because, you know one of the cases that Uncle Nino hates the most? He hates your Bowers versus Hardwick. Bowers versus Hardwick was a Supreme Court case, if you don't know or don't remember, in which a statute which criminalized homosexual conduct was struck down as a violation of constitutional liberties. And he's still hooting about how pissed off he is about it. Because, you know, your individual states have your individual states' rights that are reserved to your individual states, and the individual states acting on behalf of your people there is free to say whatever is going to be and ain't going to be illegal. It's perfectly within the purview of your individual states to say that the homos doing the homo things is illegal. They could even prescribe the death penalty for it like they got over there in your Iran, who sometimes has a good idea, I must admit. Really? Oh. Uncle Nino was in a foul and shitty mood when he wrote this. The opinion is couched in a style that is as pretentious as its content is egotistic. You know, a little like this. It is one thing for separate, concurrent, or dissenting opinions to contain extravagances, even silly extravagances like mine, of thought and expression like mine. It is something else for the official opinion of the court to do so. Of course, the opinion's showy profundities are often profoundly incoherent. The nature of marriage is that through its enduring bond, two persons together can find other freedoms, such as expression, intimacy, and spirituality. Really? Whoever thought that intimacy and spirituality, whatever that means, were freedoms? Nina? If you don't settle down, we're going to have to get the Thorazine dart, buddy. Not the dot! I hate the dot! See, he can't, spirituality kind of goes hand in hand with religion, doesn't it? Well, not mine, it don't. You walk in, you throw some water at yourself, you bow to the altar, you say some Hail Marys to the Blessed Mother, you rub the barbed wire into your thigh real good, you rub the hair shirt against your body, and you go home, and you take it off, and you have the old lady whip you with your flagellum. That's your religion. Fuck your spirituality. Bunch of goddamn liberals. Spirituality. Sitting around drinking peyote tea and staring at candles and seeing shit. And if intimacy is one would think that freedom of intimacy is a bridge rather than expanded by marriage. Ask the nearest hippie. This poor dumb fuck's locked in 1967. Archie Bunker's a goddamn liberal to Nino Scalia. Yeah, you free love there, baby. I tried your free love one time. It made it hype when I peed. Ask your nearest hippie. this is some restaurant quality unglued coming. Expression sure enough is a freedom, but anyone in a long-lasting marriage will attest that that happy state constricts rather than expands what one can prudently say. Just ask my wife. I'll be here all week. Don't forget to dip your saver. Try the veal. No, really, I don't want to have to send somebody around. We bought a lot of veal. Try the fucking veal. See, that's your right-wing jab there about how the little woman cries sometimes when you slaps her around a bit. Because the Constitution don't prevent you from slapping around the old lady when she gets mouthy. What do you mean we ain't having tomato gravy on Sunday? We've had tomato gravy on Sunday for every Sunday for the past 50 years, you cow! What do you mean your feet hurt? Get up. See, that's the thing I wanted to say. when she said we wasn't having a tomato gravy on Sundays like we've always had. But I didn't, because, you see, intimacy constricts what things one should prudently say. You get the joke, eh? Huh? Huh? Yeah, I'm going to take this shit on the road. Rights, we're told, can rise from a better informed understanding of how constitutional imperatives define a liberty that remains urgent in our own era.
Huh? What, Edith, huh?
How can a better informed understanding of how constitutional imperatives, whatever that means, define whatever that means, an urgent liberty, never mind, give birth to a right? And we are told that in any particular case, either the equal protection or due process clause may be thought to capture the essence of a right in a more accurate and comprehensive way than the other, even as the two clauses may converge in the identification and definition of the right. What say, huh? What possible essence does substantive due process capture in an accurate and comprehensive way? It stands for nothing whatever, except those freedoms and entitlements that this court really likes. And the Equal Protection Clause, as employed today, identifies nothing except the difference in treatment that this court really dislikes. Hardly a distillation of essence. If the opinion is correct that the two clauses converge in the identification and definition of a right, that is only because the majority's likes and dislikes are predictably compatible. I could go on. And does. The world does not expect logic and precision in poetry or inspirational pop philosophy. It demands them in the law. Unfortunately, I am unable to meet the demands. Because, frankly, my brain's been on vacation for a long, long time, and all that's left is this what you see here, is this pustulant meat bag of bile and bitterness and hate. The stuff contained in today's opinion has to diminish this court's reputation for clear thinking and sober analysis, which I will soon not be, and often am not when I sit down to my typewriter. Hubris is sometimes defined as overweening pride, and pride, we know, goeth before a fall. That's your Bible verse there, to make sure everybody understands that I'm a-standing with the Lord in all this here. The judiciary is the least dangerous of the federal branches because it is neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the executive arm. You know, that black arm that's going to be all around our good white necks from that one in our White House. And the states, even for the efficacy of its judgments. With each decision of ours that takes from the people a question properly left to them, with, of course, the necessary influence to make sure they reach the right decision. You know, it's a lovely house you got there, people. It'd be a shame if it went to the ground in the middle of the night. With each decision that is unabashedly based not on law but on the reasoned judgment of a bare majority of this court, we move one step closer to being reminded of our impotence. And trust me, you don't want to be reminded of your impotence because, well, I think that's why I didn't get the Sunday gravy last week. I dissent. Signed, Nino Scalia. My apologies. Got it wrong. Steve reminds me. See, that's why you guys are out there. Bowers versus Hardwick said it was okay to have anti-sodomy laws. It was Lawrence versus Texas that overruled Bowers, and Fat Tony loves him some Bowers, hates him some Lawrence versus Texas. Meanwhile, thank you. This is so kind. A little note from VJ. Bob, you've outdone yourself. I thought your Lindsey Graham voice was hilarious, but this is insane hilarious. You have a hidden talent for accents and voices. Thanks, and keep up the good work. Signed, VJ. Thank you, VJ. And a note from Kate out on the Front Range. Subject line, we have not learned. I, too, Kate says, shed some tears of joy this morning. However, I'm sad because I recall the day back in December 73 when Roe versus Wade was announced. We were all so relieved. I listened to a lot of talk this morning on Sirius Insight, lots of young, energetic, informed folks. There was a lot of joy and celebration. Most of them are under 50. So my question is, what's changed? There are still places where we are not welcome, where someone has to have control of our reproductive rights, where we can be fired for being queer or at least not accepted in the housing market. The white right wing are still winning. This post is rambling because I have no coherent words for how I'm feeling, lots of wind blowing through the empty spaces. I fear for those coming up behind me. I hope they've studied history. In my opinion, nothing has changed. A lot of those folks couldn't find the 14th Amendment, let alone understand voting laws, etc., with both hands. Humming the Rainbow Connection in 100-degree heat this day, signed Kate on the Front Range. And I know exactly what Kate's talking about because I was feeling some of the same things. I tweeted and Facebooked out earlier today that somewhere in America, right now, as you and I speak, a good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical fundamentalist is planning to murder something, murder someone, or a lot of someones, in the name of their understanding of God. And that very thought gives me the horrors, because given today's decision, today's announcement, that next group of someones may not be black folks sitting in a church. They may get the week off. It may be somebody at a pride parade. Or some people sitting in a bar. Or a married couple in their home. As the next roofie blows through the door and says, "You're destroying our traditional family values," and begins to squeeze the trigger. And yes, just as Kate noted, and by the way, you're getting a couple of "we love you, Kate." Just as Kate noted, in 32 states in the United States of America, you can still be fired for being gay, whether you're married or not. Housing discrimination, healthcare discrimination. It's actually going to take government work to put this ruling into effect. And if you think the Congress of the United States is going to lift a single goddamn finger to effect those necessary changes, oh, I got a bridge to sell you. I'm not trying to pour cold water on anybody's celebrations. This is a beautiful moment. But as I noted earlier, it is a beautiful moment that requires continued dedication and continued work. You think they're just going to roll over in Alabama? Think again. Today, on American Family Association Radio, well, we'll get to that in a little bit. It's Friday on the Front Porch. I've already filibobstered 20 minutes into the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable conversation. It's time we got that started. Still waiting for someone to step up and match Steve's $25 challenge so we can be fully $100 toward our $400 fundraising, not goal, but necessity this evening. Going into a hole next week, starting out next week in a hole. knowing that we're going to have a whole week of no broadcasts. Eh, that poses a problem. So hopefully we won't. We'll take a little break and come back with the Friday on the Front Porch Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable. You're listening to Conversation Radio, listener-supported, in fact. This is The Horn. I'm Bob.
Daddy didn't pull out, but he never apologized. Rock and roll means well, but can you tell in your boy's life? A baby on the way is a good enough reason to get you out of life. Get you out without having to swallow any pride. Friends are restless, all they do is talk it down. Two or eight lanes, it don't matter, it's just another town. There's a fool on every corner, on every street and everyone. And I'd rather be your fool nowhere than go somewhere and be no one's. So marry me, sweet thing, won't you marry me? Your mama thinks I beat anything she's ever seen. Well, this old town's all right with me. It's nowhere I'd rather be. Long as they stay mad at one another, well, they can't get mad at me. Every time I leave here, something bad happens to me. Like a busted hand or finding some man laying where I sleep. She don't mean nothing to me, that's just how it goes around here. It's a cartoon town, I played my part and I ain't spoke her name in years. So marry me, sweet thing, won't you marry me? Your mama thinks I beat anything she's ever seen. Well, this old town's alright with me. There's nowhere I'd rather be. Long as they stay mad at one another, well, they can't get mad at me. Don't want anything I done to be nobody's fault. Even if they got no money in my house and they got bought. That's just how it went down. Right or wrong, it's just that way. Just cause I don't run my mouth don't mean I got nothing to say. Won't you marry me? Your mama thinks I beat anything she's ever seen. Well, this old town's alright with me. There's nowhere I'd rather be. Long as they stay mad at one another, well, they can't get mad at me. Marry me, sweet thing, won't you marry me? Marry me, sweet thing, won't you marry me?
Yeah,
solo effort from the inimitable Mike Cooley. Marry Me. This is Friday on the Front Porch on the Horn. By the way, that comes from the recording The Fool on Every Corner. It's a good, good record. Even, well, I don't know, maybe it's on vinyl. It's a great one to have in your collection. It is Friday on the Front Porch for this, the 26th day of June, 2015. I'm Bob Kincaid. And with us over on the Skype line, of course, is the one and only Sparky, who has moderated for Yay Verily these many, many years, the Horn Malloy Skype chat group. Hey, Sparky. Wait a minute. Wrong button. Right button. Hey, Sparky.
Hey, Bob. Can you hear me?
I got you. Great.
Okay. This tomato gravy, how much flour do you put in it?
I got no idea.
Because I got a shitload of tomatoes coming on.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful. No, actually, it's Sunday gravy is what I think it's officially called. And it's delicious.
Oh,
it's delicious.
I thought you called it tomato gravy.
Maybe I did, but I was kind of, you know, I was on a roll, man.
Oh, okay. Love the voice.
Well, thank you.
Who did the request on Facebook again?
That was Michael. Michael in Madison.
Oh, cool.
He said after the decision, the only thing that would make him any happier was hearing Fat Tony's pissy descent done with The Voice.
Okay, Tim from L.A. is going to join us later, I hope.
I do, too. I've been wanting to get a report in from the General Assembly.
From Oregon, yeah. I mean, I'm getting information from him all week about how he loves the place.
Really? He loves Oregon?
Well, he's enjoying his time in Portland.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not. I didn't mean to make it sound like it was surprising. It's just that Tim's such an Angeleno.
Well, you never know. He might move to Oregon. Maybe be closer to Canada.
Well, yeah, and I mean, Portlandia. I'm sure Portlandia would suit him nicely.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, a reminder because things have been a little bit squirrely, but anyone wanting to get into the Friday on the Front Porch conversation via the regular telephone, the stress line. That number is 304-640-8185. 640-8185. Just so folks will know. Well, let's check in with the rest of the group. I haven't seen Alex in a while. Hey, Alex.
Hey, everybody. Yeah.
Good to see you this evening. Hear you, that is.
Thank you. Yeah, good to be here.
How proceeds life in Arizona, Stan?
They're pistol packing, flag waving, and baking cookies on their dashboard. It's so damn hot.
And crazier than a sprayed roach, right?
Woo!
I mean, not everybody, but you know, your right wing is there.
They have a special brand of crazy here.
So, do you feel like you've fully settled in now?
Well, I found a surprise atheist group on Facebook.
I've never heard of surprise atheists. Do they jump out from behind corners or what?
Well, they have they all look like they're in a pod, and then we have to like recognize each other and say some sort of like interplanetary code, and then we can recognize each other.
Ah, like calling occupants of interplanetary craft, you know, and the high signed on the down low. Yeah,
that too.
So I found the Atheists of Surprise group, and it's very heartening, and we're going to meet each other, so I feel better now.
Oh, wait. Okay, so Surprise is a place in Arizona,
Surprise,
right?
Arizona. Yeah, I live in Surprise, Arizona.
Yeah, it only took me a half a day. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Hey, so, yeah, it's a little town. It's a little hamlet, you know, near a community near Phoenix where it's pretty damn conservative and kind of like and so when I saw the Facebook page with Atheists of Surprise, I all of a sudden feel happy.
Oh, I can understand it. And I'm sorry, I realize there really is a Surprise, Arizona, but I just love that name. I can just see this person with this astonished look on their face going, "What? There's no God?"
Yeah, exactly. Flabbergasted.
Yeah.
Every time I tell somebody.
No. Atheist.
Sorry,
no. Atheist of Flabbergast is in Wisconsin.
Oh, then I should just say shocked. I'm, you know, shocked as shit.
Right. Well, we're awfully glad to have you on board this evening.
Thanks.
Hey, Tim, is that you? Maybe? Okay.
Yeah, that's me. I'm on.
Awesome.
Signal's kind of weak, though.
Are you...
sorry if the signal's weak.
No, you're doing fine. So are you, you're still on the ground there in Greater Oregonia?
Yes, I'm at the convention center at the GA, at the Unitarian Universalist Dinner Center.
No, atheist. Atheist.
Stand by. Okay, much better. So is it everything you were hoping it was going to be? Tim?
Yes, and a lot more. I'm very, very... I am at the convention center. Everyone is very accommodating. I'm on a scooter because I can't walk right now.
Yes,
and everyone's helpful.
Wow. So you're able to get around and have you been in a bunch of meetings?
Yeah, I've been a few workshops. Yes, I have. And I'm also was manning the drum, which is Diverse and Revolutionary Unitarian Universalist Multicultural Ministries. Booth. And I just found out right now, one of our members put into our Faithify account, she wants to start writing the book and we're going to start collecting funds. I'm like, oh my gosh, they're doing it again? Cool. But in all, it's really a great experience. And I'm doing something I would never do in LA. I'm drinking water from the water fountain. Which is kind of strange because the water here is clean.
It doesn't have and by clean you mean you can't taste it? It's colorless, colorless and odorless and all that stuff water's supposed to be?
Like LA water? Yeah. And it's clean too, and the air is clean too, believe it or not.
So,
and the cops, guess what? The cops are cool here too.
Well, the cops, I mean, how could you possibly do something to get on the wrong side of the law? I mean, are you telling me that the radical Unitarians are going out into Portland by night and burning question marks in people's yards?
Holy shit, that's funny. That is awesome. And there was a...
Wait a minute. This will pass in a second. I hope.
Plenary session this morning when the SCOTUS said they allow. Was that me?
No, you're all right. You're all right. Just try. You said you were at the plenary session. You said you were at the plenary session when the SCOTUS decision was announced.
Session, when the SCOTUS said that same-sex marriage. It's legal in all 50 states. Everyone went nuts.
Beautiful.
And they broke the news, and they're like, oh, my God.
Or, oh, my nothing. I mean, it's Unitarian, right?
Yeah. Like, oh, my God. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my sky spooker or whatever. Yeah.
Oh, my deity of your choosing.
Exactly.
Or not at all. Right.
Exactly, and that's how we roll. But it was really, and that was the talk this morning. And we were just chatting. People just broke out into conversation. And we said, Obamacare passed, same-sex marriage passed. And we just had a conversation, which was really great. But this Saturday, though, I don't know how long this happiness is going to last because I'm doing a workshop with five other people of color. And we're talking about the experiences that people of color from the Unitarian Universalist congregation are experiencing. And a lot of them are very, very, very angry. So we're saying, I wonder what's going to happen to the white you folks. And it's going to be challenging, but hey, that's what you use are.
Well, sure.
That's what we are. And if they get pissed off, hey,
Well, you know, into each life some rain must fall. Of course, that's
but in all,
you know, using rain as a negative metaphor is probably one of those things that went out with the 20th century, isn't it? That'd be a good thing.
Certainly, in California, yeah. It's gone out of use.
What do you got against rain?
Hey, there you go. Nothing wrong with it.
Hey, Rick.
Not
hey, how are you, Bob?
Maybe some better, which is a bonus.
Yeah, well, you know, I must compliment you as well for your Fat Tony imitation. I mean, you just have that, like, down pat, man. You could do, like, a whole stand-up comedy routine just using his voice, I think, Bob. You know, I was rolling, you know?
You know, I've even gotten a couple of notes saying it's halfway passable as your general New York accent there.
It is. It is. The Italian New York.
I'll be the judge of that.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Always there's a critic.
Always a critic, yeah.
Come out of the woodwork.
What kind of hillbilly are you when you can speak different accents? And he's...
Well, that's what passes for your hillbilly diversity.
Cosmopolitan hillbilly.
That's cranberry.
Is that an Ami Morxon?
No, that's a glass of cold moonshine with a little splash of cranberry juice in it.
He's a bon vivant. He's a bon vivant.
There you go. Oh, it's those fancy Frenchy words there, Alex. That was good. That was really good news, though. I kind of half expected. The only thing that surprised me is the decision was not 6-3, because I thought that the Chief Justice had enough sense to be on the right side of history, you know, because he's very, as you've said, he's the smartest Republican in the country, you know, and, you know, he voted on the wrong side, which is kind of surprising, because I would have thought he would have maybe switched again, but maybe the people were so upset at him for the ACA decision that he figured, well, I better not. disappoint my base again.
I think there's more truth in that than perhaps even you believe, Rick, because the fact of the matter is, had he signed on with this opinion, one of those Christians might have killed him.
Oh, you know?
Because, you know, they will do that.
Yeah, right.
Because I'm
right.
I'm pretty sure Dylann Roof wasn't, you know, an atheist. Or a Muslim?
No, he's an evangelical.
Oh, was he evangelical?
Yeah.
Oh, geez. Or evil-jelical. It's probably the right way of calling it.
Same thing.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, you probably do have a point, Bob. I mean, the country is, you know, it's so divided. There's so many crazies out there that, yeah, he could have become a big target, you know? I mean, not that he isn't already as, you know, a high government official, but, you know, but somebody could really, you know, a lot of people could take it really personally and, you know, go after him.
You know, to be honest with you, by the way, though, I'm glad that they approved the same-sex marriage now, since we're in Portland, because if you're in Louisiana and you have, like, 4,000 or 5,000 people who support same-sex marriage, I think in Louisiana or somewhere, people might, you know, the gun carriage, it might go nuts. So we were saying, we're sort of glad it happened now instead of like 2 years from now.
Not with the cold water, but I just want to temper this with a little bit of prudence. Because you've got that Rick Scarborough character. You may recall Billy Joe Bob Bubba's letter from Wednesday night asking should he pray or send a gas card. Rick Scarborough says preachers may have to burn over this. I mean, they're getting their martyr on in a big way, and it's frightening.
Let them die. I couldn't care less.
Pastor brother, governor, presidential candidate, diabetes, huckster, patent medicine salesman Mike Huckstaby had a hissy. He said, "The Supreme Court has spoken with a very divided voice on something only the Supreme Being can do, redefine marriage. I will not acquiesce to an imperial court any more than our founders acquiesced to an imperial British monarch. We must reject and we must resist and reject judicial tyranny, not retreat."
Well, if they don't want to marry, then don't marry then, you morons.
Oh, amen. But he went on and said that the Supreme... Get this. Yeah, I mean, you know, really, get a load of this. He said the Supreme Court ruling was unconstitutional.
When Mike Huckabee had a hissy.
You got that?
So,
the Supreme Court's ruling was unconstitutional.
Right.
Rick, does that not make you kind of like tear at your hair?
Who's this legal scholar who says that, Bob?
That would be Mike Huckstaby.
Real British monarch. We must reject and we must resist.
Oh, that was weird.
I think every time Roger tries to come in, some strange thing goes on.
Yeah, it does. Just a second, folks.
Fred.
Something in his machine.
Have him take a number. I'll call him back. Okay. That makes no sense. I mean, is Huckstaby's not even a lawyer, is he, Bob?
No. He's barely a human being, Rick.
Well, yeah, exactly.
He said,
yeah.
"This ruling is not about marriage equality. It's about marriage redefinition. This irrational, unconstitutional rejection of the expressed will of the people in over 30 states will prove to be one of the court's most disastrous decisions, and they've had many. The only outcome worse than this flawed, failed decision would be for the President and Congress, two co-equal branches of government, to surrender in the face of this out-of-control act of unconstitutional judicial tyranny."
Jesus! You know, these people are, they are psychotic, they are insane, they are nasty, they are murderous, they are
Christian.
I love those adjectives, Alex. Come up with a few more.
It's, and there's so many of them, and they're all over the airwaves, all over the TV. It's just, they're just consuming every corner of the media, and they're everywhere.
And they're nuts. But the other part is they're dangerous. You know, I read this, and I just wanted to say, hey, Mike, you want a match?
Yeah, they're anti-democratic, too, basically. They refuse to abide by the law. You know, they trumpet this thing, oh, you know, we're going to follow the rule of law, you know. Oh, we've got to impeach Clinton because, you know, it's the rule of law and all this nonsense. And then when the courts rule against them, they refuse to take, you know, no for an answer, and they want to challenge the authority of the court. So, you know, they can't have it both ways. Either you accept judicial rulings, whether you agree or disagree with them, or you have open rebellion. And I think, I think the Southerners tend to go for the, it's more of a cold civil war rather than an open rebellion, Bob, you know, as you've coined the term.
Well, he continued and he said, "The Supreme Court can no more repeal the laws of nature and nature's God on marriage than it can the law of gravity." Of course, in other times...
They don't believe in gravity.
Right.
Yeah, they don't believe in science.
Right. Gravity's only a theory. Under our Constitution, the court cannot write a law, even though some cowardly politicians will wave the white flag and accept it without realizing that they're falling on their sword. They're failing on their... I thought he was going to say falling on their sword, and I was going to... Yay! They are failing on their sworn duty to reject abuses from the court. If accepted by Congress and this president, this decision will be a serious blow to religious liberty, which is the heart of the First Amendment.
I've worked on many psych ward. I've worked on many a psych ward, and a lot of people on psych wards are very verbose, and a lot of them are very articulate, but they're psychotic nonetheless.
Alex, could you diagnose the Huckstaby from, let's say, what, 2,000 miles away, kind of like Terry Schiavo was diagnosed by Bill Frist, Dr. Bill Frist in the Senate.
Yeah.
I know.
delusional, megalomaniac, delusional, narcissistic personality disorder.
Is he a sociopath or a psychopath or not?
Every path you can imagine.
Okay.
He checks out on so many axes of the DSM-4. He looks like a freaking bush.
No, Bob. I got a question.
These people are just crazy, but they happen to have been, they happen to have had the great fortune of being able to function, be crazy, and then find themselves in these positions of power. So this is a certain class of crazy people that somehow finesse their way into these positions of power.
Basically by stepping over and stepping on top of a lot of people, I think, you know?
Hey, Bob, you said something interesting that Huckabee said. He said that they're violating the Constitution by legislating, you know, the SCOTUS. Well, then I have a question. What about the Hobby Lobby case? You know, religion as, you know, wouldn't that still be the same thing?
No, because they like that.
Yeah.
Cafeteria style constitution.
Yeah, I mean, at a basic level, one thing Huckabee does not understand is that the Supreme Court is the ultimate arbiter of what is and is not constitutional in this country, and whatever they say is or isn't constitutional is or isn't, and there is no further appeal or no further way to challenge it unless Congress wants to, let's say, you know, Congress and the legislatures decide to adopt an amendment to the Constitution.
Well, Rick, there is one other avenue. It's called violent revolution, which is what which is what these bastards are calling for. Because, I mean, take, for instance, this line, if accepted by Congress and the President, this decision will be a serious blow to religious liberty. I don't know where you went to law school. But
UCLA.
In my constitutional law class, and granted, I just went to a little podunk state school, you know, Harvard on the Mon up in Morgantown.
Great school, though. You've learned a lot.
I sat in my constitutional law class, and I had a pretty decent professor. And he never got to, maybe I missed that lecture about how when the Supreme Court hands down a decision, the President and the Congress then decide whether or not they accept it.
Well, yeah, that generally that's not an issue unless you happen to be President Andrew Jackson and don't want, you know, and want to go ahead with the Indian Removal Act. You know?
Yeah, you and what army?
So are you saying, Rick, that, because he kind of did. Mike Huckabee just called for the government.
Disobedience.
Well, no, just called for the government to behave like a genocidalist.
Right. Well, more. Yeah, I guess if you could connect that to the Indian removal, yeah. Yeah, right. Or to Jackson, yes, I know what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right. Ultimately, that's
man,
what
he's
saying.
Man, that's some God of love right there.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't get this. I mean, you know, the President and the Congress, you know, they have separation of powers and are co-equal branches and, separate but equal, not separate but equal, but they have, you know, co-equal power. It's a division of responsibility for governance. And if the executive and Congress have to approve of a Supreme Court decision, then, you know, you're going to have anarchy. What's the point of having a Supreme Court then? You might as well just have a dictator, right?
Yeah, I guess
you're
right.
I don't hear anything.
Hey, let me do one other thing real quick. Let me welcome Kevin to the conversation. He's over on the stress line, I think. Are you there, Kevin?
Yep, I'm here. And, I totally agree with you and Diane, Bob. That's my biggest worry right now, is that, one, there's somebody in these southern states will take their anger out on somebody else. And then, two, that our side, I use scare quotes for that, will get so confident that I got emails today. We won. We won. We won what? You know, I mean, it is a victory in the sense of, yes, you're now free to marry in all 50 states, but wins like this do not come without a cost, and 2016 is just around the corner, and a Republican president and a Republican Congress will wipe out everything we work for. So,
well, look, in all 50 states, you can now get married. In 32 of the 50 states, once you're married, you can be refused access to decent housing because you're gay.
Yep.
You can be denied voting if you're black, depending on the state you live in.
We have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But I think it is a big victory, though, because, I mean, it's part of the arc of history being in favor of civil rights. I mean, it is a civil rights issue, you know, being able to marry the one that you love, regardless of whether it's the same or opposite sex or whatever. And, you know, there is no way to take this right away short of, you know, the Supreme Court overturning the decision or there being a constitutional amendment to basically, forbid same-sex marriage. But, I mean, that was the whole idea behind DOMA back in the Clinton era. And that got overturned mainly by the courts. But I don't see us going back. I think, you know, this is, you know, same-sex marriage is here to stay, so I don't think it's subject to, you know, electoral politics at this point in time. You know, so I think all in all it's a good thing, but we have a long ways to go, and we have to, you know, the Voting Rights Act has to be, reenacted. Section 5, I think, was the one that had all the enforcement powers. And, you know, to get that reenacted, they've got to, have a bipartisan effort. I don't know if that's going to happen. And then you got all this problem with the redistricting and, you know, the upcoming Supreme Court case next term, which is going to challenge the one vote, the one person, one vote principle.
Yeah, Rick.
And make it like one registered voter, you know, one vote, which is going to very...
Yeah, fast track too.
Well, the TPP, I'm afraid, is probably that train has probably left the station. I think that's going to become the law, unfortunately, because of the votes that we had this week in Congress. All it takes is a bare majority of both houses now for the TPP to get passed after the negotiations have been completed and the treaty has been agreed on by the treaty parties, then you get it ratified by the, not really ratified, but I guess approved by both houses of Congress. So I think we have to move forward on other issues. I mean, I think we can still fight the TPP, but I think the chances of defeating it now are probably slim and none, with maybe none having a slight edge.
Yeah. Well, you might find this interesting. It's a separate topic, but a note just came in from Steve in China. That note in China. Okay, this is... he says, a hot topic over here today is Confederate flag, racism, and its roots in the home, terrorism, and the obvious connections. This is in China. Government terrorism expert is debating the issue with an African-American religious studies professor from the University of Pennsylvania. And it's not a 30-second soundbite before the fluff piece on Hollywood pregnancies or even how much Walmart hates that nasty thing all of a sudden. They're also not afraid to juxtapose a gigantic blow-up of the flag with a disturbing image of cheering KKK in full bedsheet regalia and a beaming soccer mom evidently pleased as punch to punctuate her hate as well. Steve says, I guess some things on the TV box actually work over here.
Sounds like they got more media transparency than the U.S. in some ways, Bob.
They've got the Great Firewall of China and everything, but oddly enough, the stream gets all the way through to Steve, so, yeah. Which cannot be said in many countries of this world. There are countries in this world where we don't reach.
Right. But you're reaching a whole lot of countries. I'm amazed, you know. I love it, you know. We have Carol a lot of times on board. She's off the porch tonight, apparently, but I'm sure she'll be back. And I know that who's the fellow who was in Africa? Was it
Australia?
Was it Mauritania or was it Madagascar? Who was that?
Oh, that's Waggy.
Waggy,
formerly of Texas.
Yeah, and then we have some Dutch folks.
We got friends in Holland, friends in Sweden, friends in Norway, friends in Finland, friends in the UK, in Ireland. I don't know if we've ever heard from Scotland.
Friends in LA.
Friends in LA, which is both Los Angeles, which is both Los Angeles and Lower Alabama.
Right.
Or Louisiana.
Friends in Louisiana, Stan. We've got listeners in Costa Rica, Australia, Japan. It's really quite amazing.
I think you need to shoot for Mongolia now, Bob.
I left out Germany. Can't forget Germany.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
And Argentina.
Argentina?
Yeah.
Oh, Brazil, too. Brazil?
Yeah.
Yeah, Flavio's from Brazil. Well, actually from Wisconsin. He's in Wisconsin now, but he's originally from Brazil.
Well, but we've heard from Brazil in the past.
Have you? Okay.
Panama and Canada.
Yeah. Lots of good Canadian friends there. Yeah. Yeah. I love Canadians.
Our good friend Jay is part-time in the U.S. and part-time in Mexico. It's amazing. Hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, you get a real international flavor here. Great group of people here. And then you have people from New York as well.
Yeah, me and Steve, I think, right?
Yeah. Well, I was glad to hear from Richard last night, Bob, on the show. Or was it the night before?
Oh, Rich from Jersey? Before. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the night before maybe, yeah. Yeah. I hadn't heard him for a while.
Oh, I loved hearing from Rich, and I know he's been to hell and back, and I've just had him on my mind and hoping that he keeps getting better and gets over the next hump after the 4th of July, and we'll hear from him some more.
I mean, good news that he seems to be cancer-free. You know, when you get third or fourth stage cancer and to become cancer-free for any period of time is a major miracle, if you want to call it that, you know.
And by the way, you know, let's not forget, this program reaches all the way to Hooterville, too.
Right.
And that's saying something.
Well, that's the most exotic location.
Well, yeah, I mean, the last hop into Hooterville is on an old Converse tennis shoe lace and a dented empty Dandy Moore can.
That sounds like the phone I used to, you know, broadcast into my treehouse when I was a kid, Bob.
And let's not forget West Virginia.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, we do reach a few places in West Virginia. Hey, a couple of updates and thank yous are in order. Thank you very kindly to Asa.
And that's saying something.
That's the most exciting.
Who says, I'm officially depressed as a result of your filibuster today. Damn, I didn't mean to do that. And thanks also to Ralps for jumping in. Thank you very kindly. And thanks to Kate, who had such profound things to say earlier in the evening and now slightly less profound, or in some ways more so, says, hey, yous. Italians have Sunday gravy and Friday gravy. The Friday gravy has clam.
Thank you, Spartan. Thank you very kindly.
Your Sunday gravy has meat of some kind. There's no flour in the spaghetti sauce. I shudder to think of flour in the sauce. Who y'all been talking to? This information comes directly from the East New York Brooklyn Italian neighborhood. And Kate also adds, Sparky, I would drive many miles to have a basket of your tomatoes. And then she says, P.S. to everyone who has so much fun with Bob's bit, pony up some bucks to pay for it. Kate has never been shy in that regard. Kate was in fact, Kate was the first person ever to actually get on the air here and do her own outreach for program support. So thank you, Kate, and thank you for the cultural lesson on your not just your Sunday gravy, your Friday gravy as well. Note coming in from Jay Cruzen regarding the Supremes. Jay Cruzen says, I know I'm far from a lawyer, but I totally disagree with judicial review. It's not in the Constitution. It's a power they gave themselves in the Marbury versus Madison case, and it horrified Jefferson even though the case went his way. Well, the fact that John Marshall was, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, Rick, the fact that John Marshall was on the court at all horrified Thomas Jefferson. He was Jefferson's cousin. and the and they hated each other.
Was he like a royalist, Bob?
No, he was more of a federalist. And he was and John Marshall was glib and urbane and witty and sparkling and moved in all the right social circles and everybody loved him and he knew which fork to use to eat the pate with. And do you use fork on a pate? Not really.
I don't know. I don't eat it.
But anyway, Jefferson, meanwhile, was retiring and kind of reclusive and had this thin, reedy, shrill voice and wore pajamas in the daytime. Anyway.
More of a hick.
Well, yeah. Brilliant. But you know, very much a withdrawn, I guess we would call him an introvert. But
right.
It's true that judicial review itself is not in the Constitution, but the Supreme Court is.
Supreme Court is, and they arrogated that power to themselves, and nobody ever challenged them on it, so it becomes part of the fabric of American law, whether you like it or not. That's what distinguishes us from, let's say, a non-constitutional form of government like Great Britain, for example, which does not have judicial review. You know, I guess there's good and bad with regard to having judicial review. I think without judicial review, we would not have had all of the great decisions that we had in the criminal procedure area during the Warren Court, nor would we have had all of the good decisions in the, you know, with regard to civil rights, such as, you know, equality of, you know, folks based on, you know, race, religion, gender, that kind of thing. And, you know, but the downside of it is if you have a group of people in there who are radical right wing.
Well, the problem is
with them overturning acts of Congress, let's say, in the campaign reform finance area like they did in Citizens United. So I guess there's good and bad with regard to having judicial review.
Well, the problem with the Supreme Court is that as it sits there in the Constitution, it doesn't have much to do. It's just the last place you go. But you've got a Constitution sitting there, and nobody really knows what it does. And so, you know, Marshall. And again, this idea of a non-political court is just silly, isn't it, Rick?
It's totally a non-political court appointed by presidents? Come on.
What's a president but
a politician?
And so Marshall gets appointed by Adams in 1801.
Right.
And he writes Marbury versus Madison as a result of the midnight appointments.
Was that like in 1804 that came out?
Yeah.
Madison?
He was brilliant in what he did because he managed to stick it to Jefferson without Jefferson knowing he'd been stuck until the shiv was halfway into his lung. Hey, look here. I do declare, I went, son of a bitch, that John Mark, God damn.
Yeah. And he was cousins with Marshall, huh? Jefferson and Marshall?
Oh, yeah.
First cousins, huh?
In point of fact, there's a state park not too far from here called Hawk's Nest, and in its original name was Marshall's Pillars.
Oh.
For the great big sandstone rock outcropping that is here. And he was one for exploring.
Hmm.
I mean, he was, you don't hear nearly as much about Marshall as you do, say, a Franklin or God knows a Jefferson, but Marshall was a real Renaissance man. But he lacked that that merciless avarice for power that Jefferson had. Hello,
right.
Larry. Hello, Larry. Hello.
Bob, he can't hear us.
Okay.
Oh, now I can.
Now you can.
Thank you. Now I can. Yes, thank you.
Did you move the cursor on your sound bar?
No, I don't know what happened. I just turned off the iPad turned up the volume a little bit on the computer, and everything is fine. Thank you.
Okay, you can only be on one device.
Yeah, thank you.
Signed into Skype.
So, Larry, what do you think about the decision on the same-sex marriage case today? Any opinion one way or the other?
You know, I don't know anything about it. Did they say it was okay?
Absolutely. 5-4 decision.
They said it was okay for people to get married to, if the way they, you know, for same-sex marriage to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool.
You missed
Bob's... Why couldn't they have done that 100 years ago?
Well, yeah, exactly. You missed Bob's rendition of the dissent written by Fat Tony. You'll have to listen on the podcast.
Oh, well, Fat Tony, who cares? Who cares about Fat Tony?
You know that whole... I'm really upset about the Obama coming to the church in Charleston where there's something... You know, I'm just looking... I look at the whole thing and it's sad and horrible, but then I'm looking at it as they're saying God is merciful, God, we forgive him, and then they're talking about Jesus and there's a God works in mysterious ways, and they're all doing the, and it's so so horrible to see that because it.
Yeah, Alex.
You know,
Alex, you should. You should have heard Angry Indians program yesterday and how he was talking about it, and he was talking about it with his guest. So if you get a chance to hear Angry Indians latest show, check it out. Thank you.
Okay.
And one correct, Obama wasn't in a church. They were in a basketball arena on the University of Charleston or something.
No, he was at the church today at the church that he did the eulogy for Clemente.
No, he wasn't in a church when he did the eulogy.
It wasn't a church?
No, it was a basketball arena.
Because there really? Was
the pastor for the pastor?
There wasn't enough room in the church.
Oh, okay.
Okay, he was in a basketball arena and they were doing the whole God stuff, but it was so horrible to hear everyone say they're so forgiving and so God is merciful and the whole, and it just is so painful to see that because the infusion, the way that religion has completely screwed people up to the point of where they're still so infected by it that they can't even get angry and they have to do their merciful love God and reason for there's a purpose for this.
But thing. Alex, let's unpack that for a minute. And I'm not saying you're wrong. This is where this discussion is at its best. We praise, for good reason, the principles of nonviolence. We praise the nonviolence of Dr. King and the nonviolence of Gandhi. We understand that had violence been resorted to, the civil rights struggle would have simply been quashed in a sea of blood. And God knows even with nonviolence there was blood enough and death enough. And most of us, I would dare say, in our community are against the death penalty. And we praised the family of the 8-year-old boy who was slain in the Boston bombing when they said that subjecting Gokhar Tsarnaev to the death penalty would be a meaningless extension of the agony that they already suffered. Aren't we being a little bit disingenuous when we say that by resorting to their faith, there is something inherently wrong with the response of the victims or the survivors of the victims of the
Charleston? I agree with what you said, and that's where I come from. But it's I don't think there's anything inherently wrong in responding in a nonviolent way. I'm just taking a step. I'm just observing that this religion that has become part of this Christianity was stuffed down the throats of slaves when they came here, and just like everybody else, this poison of religion to me has completely distorted reality. So when they say there's a God is merciful after nine people have been slain and there was a reason for it and, you know, he works in mysterious ways, that kind of stuff, I mean, it's just upsetting because you could still react in a nonviolent way, but in a realistic way. This whole infusion of this intense God stuff just adds, it's just so twisted to me, and it's just so,
weird.
But forgiveness, Alex, isn't that more for the benefit of the person who has been wronged and their conscience than it is for the person who wronged them? I mean, does it matter, for instance, to the state, because it didn't much matter to the federal court in Boston, do you think it's going to matter much to the state of South Carolina that the murder victims' families have forgiven him?
They're still going to try to get
the death penalty for him.
I'm just looking at it from a perspective of, look at what religion has done, and people are wearing funny clothes and singing hymns and talking about the Bible and Jesus and the Lord, and in the worst of times, I know that these people are so entrenched, and this is what they are, you know, this religion stuff. But it just is, to me, it's unnecessary, and it's, to me, I feel pity that this has to be part of it, that the religion has to be part of it, you know.
Particularly in the case of this funeral today, Clemente Pinckney was, yes, a state senator from South Carolina, but he was a preacher out of that church. How are they going to give him a funeral without reference to his faith?
Yeah, I'm just taking a little step back and saying, observing it and going, wow, you know, I understand that. But it's like, look at what religion has done, you know, to people, you know, it's just...
Rick and Alex and Bob, I don't want to take words out of Angry's mouth, and I'm not quoting him directly, but the general thrust of his conversation is we're asking for forgiveness from a white man who has murdered a bunch of African Americans, but we don't ask for the same kind of forgiveness, or we don't ask, you know, for the same kind of mercy when an African American goes in and does that to a bunch of white. You know, that's the thrust of what Angry
was talking
about.
But that shows, Larry, that some people are more evolved and more humane and more morally, ethically, and spiritually developed than others, precisely for that reason. If the coin had been flipped and it had been a black man who went into a white church and wiped out, oh, say, Mike Huckabee and eight other people, the white people would have gone crazy. And I only say that because they have a history of doing that.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, I think the point that Alex was trying to make, perhaps, is that, you know, when people emphasize the religion part of it, it gives them a pass to do nothing to try to solve the underlying problem that led to the atrocity, i.e., you know, some gun reform here and making it more difficult for people to own guns and to use them in mass murders, basically. And, you know, if you say, oh, it had, you know, these people died as part of God's plan, this, that, and the other thing, well, it's like maybe it is part of God's plan if God is Wayne LaPierre, but, you know, otherwise, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. So you have the spectacle of the mass shooting, and then within a week or so you have the president speaking at a memorial service and talking about how bad it is, and it's sort of like Groundhog Day all over again every time you have one of these gun tragedies. And by invoking religion, I guess you basically give the powers that be a free pass to continue to do nothing to solve the problem of the violence itself. I don't know.
May I throw in 2.5 cents?
But not a centime more, Roger.
Okay, I'll just keep it brief. The notion of forgiveness rings somewhat kin to my ear, but I think that the real point that is underlying it is, look, we're superior to you vindictive motherfuckers. We're superior. We will forgive because we're willing to, because we are superior. I think it's a gesture of almost noblesse oblige.
As long as we still look to a spook in the sky to deal with all of this shit, we're fucked.
Yes, Roger, I love you.
Well, very, very plain spoken, Roger.
I know, and you know what?
Sorry about it, but that's my attitude.
Right, no. You know what, Roger? We're 20% of the country that can cope with that. 80% of the United States can't. All right?
I know that.
And their holy book has a lot to say. You know,
holy book is a fucking piece of mythology that they shouldn't even be dealing with, and they're too fucking stupid to figure it out.
Okay, who here has seen that Star Trek episode about Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra? Okay, when the walls fell, it's a people who communicate only by metaphor. Well, that's Christian America. If you can get Christian America to understand what a horrible bind we are in gun violence by citing Jesus Christ looking at Peter and saying, Peter, put up thy sword, for those who live by the sword will die by the sword. You know, by any means necessary, I want this country to figure out that it has got to solve its gun problem. By any means necessary, I want this country to figure out that it has to solve its race problem. By any means necessary, I want this country to figure out that it has got to solve its homophobia problem. And if we have to use the Bhagavad Gita, the holy books of Zoroastrianism, the Diamond Sutra, Confucius's writings, the Quran, the Talmud, the Torah, the New Testament, and the Mayan Book of the Goddamn Dead, then I say by all means use them, as long as we can get this country to figure out where it is and what's got to be fixed.
Amen, Brother Bob.
May I throw in my clarification? When I was talking about superiority, I wasn't talking about them having an attitude that their religion makes them superior. I was talking about their willingness to be truly in the image of a large heart, and having been educated by being victims through the ages, that they've grown into greater people. I'm talking now about particularly the black experience in this country. I think many of those people are superior to most white people, and that's what I meant. I wasn't really thinking about the religion, except only to the extent that they may understand the true heart of what Jesus was trying to teach.
Okay. Well, they're holding on. You know, I can understand they're part of a giant cult who, in these times of trouble, like people on an individual basis, I have friends that have cancer, have gone through stuff, and they still say they believe in Jesus, and Jesus is watching out for them, and they, really? Well, if Jesus was watching out for you, then why did he allow all this stuff to go down? You know, it doesn't make sense. And I know that these folks are in terrible grief, and they have to hold on because they're in this cult, and this is what they hold on to, and I understand it, but it's a shame because it is all make-believe, and it is negative that there's so many people involved in this, and it can hold us back. It does hold us back from having these changes that you were talking about, Bob, with gun control and less homophobia and all this stuff. So I was just looking at that whole service and going, wow, you know, look what, just observing that piece of it and going, even now with this, it's like so intense, and they're doing this make-believe stuff, and it's, you know, not, it's just, a, you know.
Well, I think it's faith. It's, you know, faith is not based on reason, Alex. That's where these people come from. That's the whole difference between, you know, the evangelicals and even let's say, you know, pious, you know, African Americans who are very religious and, you know, a lot of other people, you know, it's a matter of faith. So, you know, I think you kind of have to understand, you know, where they come from. And it gives them comfort. I mean, life is hard, and whatever gets you through the night, so to speak, you know.
Rick, and let's, okay, by way of example, my mom died in 1997. My dad was not a religious man. My mom took care of the religious business in the family. My dad worked shift work, and likely as not, he was working on a Sunday at some part of the day. And if he had a Sunday off, he was not about to spend it going to church. Nevertheless, you know, he'd been steeped in his Protestant Baptist upbringing. Hell, he didn't think Baptists were Protestants. He thought we were better than that. But he wasn't a Bible banger. But after my mom died in 1997, his world fell apart. Came completely apart. His rock, the human being who had held his world together, was gone. The person who gave him definition as a decent member of the human race, who occupied a space on this planet that was not better off left to someone else, was gone. And for anyone like me who comes from, you know, the real, you know, rock solid, you know, only emotion men are allowed to have is laughing and screaming and, you know, hitting things, which is not to say that my father was a hitter. It's a hell of a thing to watch your father just absolutely collapse in tears.
How long did your father hold on after your mom passed?
10 years.
Wow.
And that's because our family, well, he was surrounded by his grandchildren and love and light, and but he was destroyed, Rick.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew what my feelings were on religion. And eventually he got around to having a discussion with me about the afterlife.
Mm.
And I told him what I felt about it, and he looked at me and the tears came to his eyes again, and he said, "Do you mean to tell me that when I die, I'm not going to see Margaret again?"
Hmm. Oh, jeez.
My question is, Alex, should I have looked at him irrationally and said, "Of course you're not, Dad. You're going to be dead. She's dead.
Nope.
You're going to be dead. Everything's going to be dead. Nobody's going to see anybody."
I might talk like this to you guys, but I am...
And I'm not calling you out. I'm trying to process through how we respond to these things.
Well, I understand. You know, I have a depth and breadth of understanding of other people. I really do understand. But I can also, at the same time, have my feelings about it, and my opinions and judgments at the simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Well, when Bob gave his explanation, I'm right there with Bob's father. I mean, I'm right there with what Bob was talking about. So when people talk to me about how, you know, I need to have something that takes the place, that gives me some of what helps me deal with what some of Bob's father went through when his wife died. And that's what I don't get if I just simply look at life in an atheistic, you know, no God, no spiritual framework. You understand what I'm saying, Bob? I mean, I don't want to believe in the sky spook, but I also feel the longing and feel the separation when I lose somebody or something that everybody goes through. But it's a little hard for me to just simply be a Buddhist about it and say, well, this is reality and this is what happened. You're just going to have to be an adult about it and just go on and just, you know, deal with it. You see what I'm saying?
I wish, thing would be if everybody had their own feelings about life and their own cult and their own religions, and it did not leave their personal space, and it was not out in public, televised, churches were, if people are entitled to their own feelings, and I have, just like anything else, be your own person, have freedom of thought, freedom of expression, free to do what you want if it doesn't hurt anyone else. But this whole thing of this Christian stuff that's 80% of this culture, and it's around me constantly and affects me in a negative way, and it's on the media, it's everywhere. It's infected our everything. So I'm talking about that, not people on a personal level, and not judging people for, I'm trying to hold on to something, or, I'm talking about just this religiosity, this craziness that just inundates our culture and the negative aspect of it, So that's what I'm talking about.
Right, and see, I can draw a bright line, Alex, between the spirituality of a funeral on the one hand and what is obviously a hateful and pernicious doctrine of theocracy on the part of the Brian Fishers and the Mike Huckstervies and the Ted Cruzes and the Bobby Jindals and the rest of those religious thugs. Okay, I mean there are so many layers of nuance to this particular discussion, and I think we're uniquely suited to having it by virtue of kind of being outside of it. Because for instance, one of the reasons I got a bigger tear in my eye when Jim Obergefell took a moment in his remarks outside the Supreme Court this morning to remember the memories of the victims in Charleston was because I saw a moment there of a healing of a very real rift, because there is a lot of anti-LGBT bigotry inside not just the pasty-faced, doughy, evangelical white church, but inside the black church, too. Okay? If you think about the Proposition Hate campaign in California, fundamentalist black churches turned out in droves to go and vote for vote in Proposition Hate.
Yeah.
And they weren't voting in favor of expanding LGBT rights. I mean, let's be clear.
And the irony is they voted in record numbers for Obama and for that accursed proposition, which how can you square those two votes in one election?
Well,
yeah,
right.
So if I feel that I personally need some spiritual solution, even though the holy books and the way in which religion is used and a lot, and religion can be used, a lot there. What I'm saying is, can I be spiritual, but not have to fall into being a dumbass, prejudiced?
The question you're asking, no, Larry, you're overthinking it. The question is, in a moment of extreme and profound grief, can I simply be humane?
Yeah, because I always ask some of the people in the group, I say, you all are atheists, but what do you do in a situation like when your father lost your mother, or when a human being feels that they've lost some kind of rock?
I lost my father, Larry, and I'm an atheist. My father died, and I felt, wow, that's a terrible loss. I'm not going to see him again. I didn't have a great relationship with him. But, needless to say, I'm sure there's a lot of very religious people that didn't have good relationships with their father. So I said, gee, that was a shame. I wish I could have had a good relationship with him. And I felt really weird, and I felt a loss. But it didn't go beyond the realistic view and reality of the situation. I didn't all of a sudden think of some other thing that was not there, or think of something outer worldly or outside myself to hold on to help me. I talked to my therapist, I talked to my sister, and time went by and, you know, the shock was, you know, done. So I don't begrudge anyone from doing anything they want to do. I just don't like this institutionalized religion thing. And you know what? It's true, these evangelicals and all these people, there's a big, you know, there's even the well-meaning, nice Christians can be harmful. I mean, even people that aren't crazy and running around and doing the stuff that, you know, these crazy huckster bees and all these other people, they, even in their niceness and in their nice spirituality, are adding to the issue, you know, are adding to the problem as well. I mean, so in their own way, I feel.
I don't agree with you on that. I don't agree with your critique of all religion as being detrimental to society, Alex. I mean, there's a lot of good things that, let's say, the Catholic worker movement does, and they're very, you know.
Yeah, popular. Anybody that does anything good is good. And I don't care, you know, but the whole...
You don't need religion for it, though. I agree.
Yeah, and let's add in here, just for the sake of just for the sake of completeness, that in the wake of today's ruling, for instance, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops behaved like a bunch of dicks, which, oddly enough, they are. Because they said, this ruling against God's natural law cannot ever stand, and it will eventually go away.
You sound like God.
So are we saying that people like Jim Wallace of Sojourners, or people like John Shelby Spong, who are liberal religious people, or Tony Campolo, those people are just as harmful coming from the left, and if they espouse, you know, radical points of view on the left as the right, as on the right. You see what I'm saying? Are we saying that too?
I don't think they're just as harmful, but I think that the religion in general, whatever, in whatever form it takes, has its own, it doesn't do any good. I don't feel that it does any good. It detracts and takes away from the goodness of a society. If any type of religion or cult, if it's out in the public and it has any kind of power other than in someone's own head or someone's own little altar in their own little basement, once it escapes out into the elements, then to me that's harmful in whatever form it takes.
Hello.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well.
Are you? Good. Can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it sounds like you're in Grand Central Station or something.
He might.
Well,
be.
I'm at my local bar.
Oh, are you in New York City?
Yeah, I live in the Bronx. That's where I am.
Oh, I was born in the Bronx, man.
Where?
Lebanon Hospital.
Okay. I'm only here a little over a year, so I live in Riverdale.
Oh, that's where all the rich New Yorkers live.
Yeah, I know. I didn't know that when I moved there.
You're far away from Lower Manhattan, though, man.
Yeah, so I know. I actually work right next to Ground Zero.
Oh, man, that's where my mother used to live, on North Moore Street.
Okay, yeah, it's a schlep, but, you know. I had to call in because I couldn't help listening to all this. It's probably fairly clear from some of my emails and whatnot that I'm not an atheist. I'm a practicing Catholic who can't stand religion. Don't ask me to explain that. I can't. I would disagree with the notion that religion is necessarily poison, and I would look at someone like a Martin Luther King or a Malcolm X, who that perspective or that motivation brought an awful lot. But I do agree that it does become poison when it becomes a reason to make public policy. And maybe that's more what you meant when you said that.
Well, and Steve, you're right in line with the framers of the Constitution on that point, and I know you know your framers, you know you're a lawyer and everything. We got two lawyers in the group tonight. Everybody else grabbed their wallets.
Hey, Steve, how are you? I'm from Southern Cal. I'm Rick.
All right. Go, believe me, I know all the players here. I listen all the time.
Cool. But that was just a joke, by the way. You know, lawyer jokes. The framers, I think it was Madison who talked about wanting a national religion. But the national religion that Madison wanted wasn't Christianity or Quakerism or Catholicism or Judaism or Buddhism or any of that. He wanted a national civic religion of, for lack of a better term, Americanism. And that's, you know, that's where the idea of religious liberty comes from. Everybody do your religion thing inside your churches and do it inside your homes. But for the love of whatever deity you worship, don't try to do it in government. Because we're going to make this country the civic religion unto itself. And that sounds a lot like what you're describing.
Yeah, no, that, I mean, I have to say, I'm very much of the opinion, you know, and I'll give you kind of what might be a strange or weird example. And I don't know if anyone on here is familiar with this little app called Foursquare, where you get people who check into everywhere they go now and again. You know, I'm going into X restaurant and they check in, so everybody knows. Well, I have friends who when they go to Mass, they check in, and it suddenly occurred to me, and I think probably, Bob, you're the one that made me think this. I'm not supposed to do that. I'm supposed to be very inconspicuous in how I practice, so I don't do that anymore. Because I don't want to be, I want to be inconspicuous. And I have a very good, very dear friend of mine who was in the seminary a million years ago in the Franciscan seminary. He ended up leaving, and he frequently tells me a quotation that St. Francis of Assisi said, and it was, "Preach often, use words if necessary." So that's kind of what I try to do, is that my quote-unquote preaching has to, I want that to be my actions. It doesn't matter. No one needs to know what my motivation is unless they ask me.
Let thy light so shine, right?
Yeah, yeah. And again, I'm not here to convert anybody, and I'm not here to tell anybody to believe.
Right. I mean, but look at, so look at the teachings of the great rabbi.
Shlomo.
No, and it's not Maimonides either. He predates Yeshua. They asked him. They said, "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment?" And he said, "Don't do." And I'm getting this wrong, and I'll get an email, and I know it.
Shalom Aleichem, maybe.
No, he said, "Don't do to other people things that you would hate to have done to yourself. The rest is commentary." But
probably Rabbi Hillel.
Yeah, that's Hillel, exactly.
That's right. That's exactly
Hillel,
right.
And he said don't. He said that, and then the next line is perfect. He says the rest is just commentary. And that's the truth. Every developed culture comes up with a rule, and they ground it in religion that says, don't be shitty to other people, or else other people will be shitty to you.
And we don't need a cult or religion or to be involved in some group think to tell us this. But oddly enough,
Alex, it's a cult or a group think or an ecclesiastical structure that teaches that lesson in every culture. You know, there are that lesson.
Yeah, and murder and all this other crap too. You know, you know, it's in the Bible, the Quran, and misogyny.
I have a question, Bob. There was a period in the 60s and 70s started by people like Aldous Huxley and Houston Smith that talked about the perennial philosophy. And now the book that's being used by the person who's teaching comparative religion at my community college is talking about the limitations of that particular notion of comparative religion and saying that we ought to really look at the differences of all the different religions separately and acknowledge their diversity. Can you explain the that why this particular author at University of at Boston University might be saying that the perennial philosophy of looking at the basic similarities between all religions as a way of mediating conflict and diversion might be limited, and why we might want to read this other book that says we ought to celebrate the diversity of all the religions.
I can't go there, Larry. Anybody else that wants to is welcome to.
I'd like to throw in on the general topic just this. When Alex made the comment that nothing good.
One minute, Roger. Hey, Steve. Steve, can you mute? Can you mute when you're not talking, please? Thank you.
Done.
When Alex made the comment that nothing good has ever or can come from religion. In many ways, except from the very personal standpoint, she did exclude that as a different matter. I was really moved to throw this in, and it seemed so apropos during the last 10 minutes conversation. And that's this, like it or not, it appears that, most early human civilization, needing some kind of government as well as some kind of explanatory story for our existence, wound up with religions becoming more or less the governing factors in society. I don't think there were any. There may well have been, who knows, Paleolithic anarcho-syndicalist. I don't know if there were any anarcho-syndicalist Paleolithic communities.
What were they going to do for bombs?
But the idea that very early government, in fact, that role was fulfilled by religion is something we should not dismiss. And what we've been doing for the last several thousand years is struggling to escape from the bonds of the false beliefs entailed and figure out how to make a society that can govern itself without the need for lies to.
Roger, I take issue with your thesis. I take issue with your thesis. I don't think that.
I'm just having an idea.
Okay. Well, I don't think that, and I could really, really, really use a hand from Dr. John on this one. But I don't think that religion necessarily derives from a need for governance. I don't think we can talk about government with scare quotes around it in terms of pre-agricultural hunter-gatherer societies.
Can I just throw this comment in? My main mentor in political science at the University of Minnesota was the famous Mulford Quickert Sibley, and he taught a very famous set of courses called the Development of Civilization, the Development of Political was the name of this series of courses, and oddly, I thought at first he focused on religious texts early on in the coursework, and pointed out the degree to which they were used as governing or organizing structures. Now, I don't think he was going back quite as far as hunter-gatherers, but I don't think I'm going to put down. Well, I just throw that in, Bob. This famous anarcho-syndicalist professor made a good point about the function of religion as a means of social organization and control.
I have made that argument, Roger, for years.
I know you have, and so I can't imagine you subverting yourself.
I'm not. But religion as a means of social control is something that comes into play once you have a headman hierarchy, once you have sedentary culture, once you have agriculture. Because, I mean, for instance, we know from a verifiable historical record that the religious practices of nomadic or semi-nomadic peoples who are essentially non-agricultural is dramatically different from the way belief systems develop and evolve in sedentary cultures. Okay, the biggest part of religion, as we understand it, begins with a kind of spirituality, and that spirituality begins with myth building. And we do myth building because we try to explain things we don't understand, not because we need to control the guy in the next tent over.
Well, those cosmological stories are obviously one of the chief origins of religion. There's no disputing. And I pointed that out in my little suggestion. But the development of increasingly urbanized or collectivized society, the existence of stories, I think, was probably an organic process that led to some people claiming that they had knowledge about these things, and then using that as a beginning of creating a framework of social control. And that's where cosmological stories, to my mind, turn potentially both evil and yet constitute organizing myths in our society.
Hey, Roger, your mic just went squirrely.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think the God may have I think the God may have stricken your words, Roger.
You know the words that I was saying bear repetition, but I won't do it now.
It's there. There'll be a record. There'll be a podcast. I mean, you didn't go entirely silent. It's like you were far away. Note coming in from the marvelously coherent Diane in Kansas stand. Subject line: Do unto others. The great Immanuel Kant came up with something. I never knew to do what to do with those A's. I can either Americanize it or leave it the way it is. The great Immanuel Kant came up with something very close to the golden rule by using pure reason in his formulations of the categorical imperative. And it's true. That question preoccupies Socrates. That question preoccupies the sages of, as Anthony Kennedy noted in his opinion today. Everybody weighs in on, you know, because this is a very circumscribed, shortened life. You know, this little life which is rounded with a sleep, as Shakespeare said. And trying to figure out how to get through it with as little misery as possible is a big part, especially of Western philosophy. Now, if you ask the Buddhas, the Buddha's going to tell you, it's all suffering. And trying to make the suffering less is just an act of futility. I never having been a practicing Buddhist, I don't know how you put that to work. Jim in Louisiana stands been one. Maybe he could answer that question, but he's not here this evening. But I feel like even as people who don't necessarily believe in organized religions and things like that, I think we can allow people their fantasies? No, their moments of solace. I won't even insult them by calling them fantasies in a moment like this. I don't have a problem calling them fantasies if your God happens to hate all the same people that you do. I got no problem saying that your God is inside your mind. But in a moment of grief, when people form community to reach out not only to themselves but to try to find some greater meaning. That's just people doing what people have done since we came down out of the trees, and maybe before, because we live in a place we don't understand. And quite often in the human experience, it is a veil of tears. And sometimes that veil of tears becomes a stage curtain of them. So, you know, that's just my thought on the issue. We lost Steve there. He was having some Skype issues, but I do want to let him know that yes, his challenge was met. And in point of fact, that as far as we've gone this evening, we got 10 minutes left in the program or so. We have reached $175, counting Steve's challenge, toward the $400 we needed to raise tonight. That leaves us $225 to go. And hopefully either in the next 10 minutes or the next 24 hours, that will be remedied. So, I'm sorry. There's an update. Thank you, Joan. Thank you, Joan, very kindly. We are at $225. That means we've only got $175 to go. And hopefully in the next 10 minutes or so, or perhaps the next 24 hours or whatever, we will come even for this week and be able to get started on next week. And yeah. So, God, I hate talking about that. I just do.
Well, you have to, Bob.
Well, yeah, it's the only way. It's the only way this continues to happen, and I know it. But I know.
I mean, there's some of us that we step up and we do our best, but we hope somebody else steps up and takes up the
slack,
takes up the mantle and carries it forward. You know, I put in $200 last.
Yes, you did. You provided the challenges that closed the gap that was similar to the gap this evening.
But I can't do it this week.
Oh no, and I think that's a bridge too far.
Yeah, I can only do certain. You know, the pull the pin challenge only happens once a month.
Right. Well, there's only one. There's only one fire extinguisher.
Yeah. It has to be recharged.
Well, exactly.
End of the month when I get my pension monies and, you know, Social Security.
That's understandable. I mean, at least you don't have to raise, like, what, $200,000 a month, like West Virginia Public Radio or whatever it is, Bob?
Well, yeah, and at least, you know, we're not a site that does nothing but text and needs to raise, you know, $60,000 a month.
All we need is just, like, Bob says, for the ACAC, 400 people to give $10 a month.
Oh, by the way, are you planning on coming out to the West Coast next month, Bob? Or
well,
is it still
I don't know. I don't know how the timing's going to work. It may get pushed out a month because I'm going to be, I'm going to be a week away from the microphone in D.C. the second week of July, and that's going to, you know, like from July 5th on.
Why are you going to California, Bob?
Well, trying to do some missionary work for the ACAC, the ACAC campaign, because this trip to D.C. is the last scrap of money we have, and so a few of us are going to go to D.C. and try to put on as much of a push as we can to get the bill introduced in the Senate.
Good luck, and wow, that's really.
I mean, we've got 200,000 Americans now who have petitioned their member of Congress, their senators, pass in the House and introduce in the Senate the ACAC. We can't just let that lay there. We've got to act on that. So we've got enough for a crummy motel room 50 miles away from D.C. and train fare in. And we're going to go for a week and bust our asses and see if we can make some progress.
Are you going to meet up with Bo?
Yeah. Bo's going to be there. I'm going to be there. Yeah.
You're going to have Ferg there, too?
No. Ferg will be holding down the ranch here.
He's going to be cooking, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have some senators in mind who you want to have sponsor the legislation, or do you have to kind of
No, we've got, not want to say right now? Well, we've got a list of some we're going to reach out to, and one of the ones that I have suggested we really should reach out to with real vigor is Barbara Boxer. Because we have thousands upon thousands of signatures from people in California in regard to the Right Act on that petition. And since she has announced that she will not run for re-election, then she's got the right, she has the ability, she's always had the right, but she has the ability to act upon her conscience. And we believe that the time has come for her to tell Joe Manchin and Mitch McConnell to go piss up a rope and do the right thing.
I'll write her a letter. I think everybody in the Horn family from California should do the same.
I agree.
Yeah, like a personal, like an old school handwritten kind of thing, or postcard.
You can't do the old school thing because it takes 6 weeks to get a letter all the way into a congressional office now.
But if it has no envelope, you can just, they don't have to go through the, you know,
screen it
in Ohio or whatever. Yeah, Norman always talks about that. You basically send postcards or emails. You basically don't have a regular letter because it has to get irradiated and checked for anthrax and all that nonsense, you know. Yeah, it does delay it by about 6 weeks, you're right, because I used to try to send stuff to the government when I was with the government, and back in D.C., that is, I'd send it back to D.C., and it would take forever to get there. They wouldn't receive stuff because of the, you know, the paranoia over the anthrax and so forth, you know.
Right.
But, yeah, I'll in any event, I'll reach out to Barbara Boxer. I think everybody else should in California, and, you know, maybe even she'd listen to non-Californians, but especially we Californians can maybe make a difference there. Hopefully. And what about Bernie as possible sponsor? Is it possible to get him?
You know, we've had good meetings with his office, but and this is a bit political, but everything is. I hesitate to expend much energy on him. Because A, he's running for president, and B, that might be part of the policy that he'd like to keep running under the radar. I don't know. The problem is we've got a very, you know, it's not like the good old days a couple of years ago when I could go for a month and take six meetings a day. You know, we've got essentially 4 days to cram in as many meetings as we possibly can.
Sort of like final exam week, right, Bob?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, good luck there. It's the week after the 4th, then, right?
Yeah, we're leaving on the 5th, and we'll be back like on the 7th.
Mm. Okay.
I mean, not
good
the,
luck.
Not the 7th. Let's see.
Good luck with that.
We'll be back. Broadcast next Friday.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll be. Okay. I'll be on the air all next week.
Okay.
So you're going to have a star-spangled show. Woo!
Wait a minute. Am I going to have a star-spangled show? Yeah, I'm going to. Yeah, we'll have a night before the 4th of July, a night before Independence Day. That's one of those things that I get cranky about. I don't call it the 4th of July. I call it Independence Day.
I think you should play Jimi Hendrix's Star-Spangled Banner as your intro for the show on the 3rd, Bob.
That sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
and hey, it is time to get out of here. Now, of course, the conversation will continue well into the night, both after this program and especially after Malloy closes at 5 past midnight Eastern time, 5 after 9 in the Pacific time zone. By all means, jump into that conversation. I heartily encourage you. It's even more rocking and rollicking and rousing off air than it is on. So I want to thank everybody who participated this evening. Kevin had to drop off because of noise, but thank you to the to Sparky for moderating the Horn Malloy Skype chat group, and thanks to everybody who participated. Thanks to everybody who keeps all of this going, all of you for your kind contributions all week long. $175 to go on the week. Can't help but got to talk about it if we want to keep this going. That's it. Y'all have a wonderful weekend. We'll be back with More In Monday, and hopefully we'll start More In Monday not in a hole. Good night, y'all. And always, of course, always, always, Gina, it's all for you.